Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, just the facts. And now, here's your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com and get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, photos, videos, mildly worded complaints, stolen internet memes, funny cat videos at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me this evening is Jack.
Yay!
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Was vacation good?
I don't care.
Oh.
It was all I ever wanted. Vacation, time to get away.
Nice. Nice. Hey, quick reminder, this segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s, Airs, and scatterguns since 1977. A legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories at www.wilsoncombat.com. And also, Aridus Industries and the patent-pending QDC Quick Detach Side Saddle Shell Carrier. Available now for pre-order. Check out the new rigid, interchangeable side saddle carrier, changing how you look at shotguns forever. Find out why Steve Fisher, Chris Fry, and myself all call it the best hard mount side saddle carrier ever invented. Would you like to know more? Visit AridusIndustries.com. So we have a Ballistic Radio first. Larry Lindemann is finally joining us on the show, which I feel really bad about because he should have been on a couple of years ago, and I don't know why I haven't gotten to it. But I'm going to be talking about a subject that not enough people cover. Let me get Larry on, and we'll get into it. So joining us, Larry Lindemann. Larry, how are you doing?
Hey, John, how are you doing?
Oh, not too bad. See, I forgot to tell you before the show, like live radio, don't curse and all that stuff. But I guess I can tell you now.
Thank you. Thanks for telling me that.
Well, you know, it's probably important, I think, something FCC finds. So I apologize, number one, for not having you on sooner. I don't know why I haven't. Number two, for those that don't know or are not familiar with you, which is a shame, but can you go over your background real quick and then we'll get into the meat of tonight's show?
Sure, John. Hey, Jack. Just wanted to say hi to you, too.
Hi, Larry.
I was a Illinois State Police officer for 26 years. Prior to that, I was actively involved in martial arts, cutting edge martial arts at the time. That kind of drove me towards police work. About 1990, I joined the Illinois State Police SWAT team. Did hundreds of search warrants and hostage rescue here or there. Was a squad leader, instructor, wrote the defensive tactics manual with a group of people for the Illinois State Police, and continue to practice today Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I'm a brown belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, had an MMA fight, and I practice with and train with a group of people who, all of which you've had on your radio show, and obviously Craig Douglas and William April, Chris Fry, Cecil, and Paul Sharp. So
I saved the best for last, Larry. What can I say?
Yeah. Well, thank you. I don't know about that, though, John.
Well, I don't know. So what I want to talk about tonight, I think, is something that, you know, a lot of people have this sort of schema in their heads, and you hear them say things like, if anybody's in my house, or if this, or if that, and it's this very definitive, hardline statement of if A, then B. And it always seems to center around, if someone's here, I will shoot them. And what I kind of want to talk about is the don't shoot yet, or are there situations where, you know, someone isn't someone that you want to shoot right away, whether or not you're legally justified to do it?
Sure. You know, it's interesting because I taught this course at Paulpalooza, and the first thing I did was I asked, has anybody been involved in a situation where they had their firearm out, but they did not fire. And out of about 25, 30 people there, two people had that situation where the firearm was out. They acquired the firearm, and they just made a decision. For whatever reason, they made a decision not to fire. And it seems to be, you know, police officers do this all the time. You know, we preemptively draw our weapons all the time and hold somebody at gunpoint. But we have the responsibility to arrest somebody. But a citizen could run into a situation where they don't have the moral or the legal authority yet to press the trigger. So that's kind of a coursework that I'm focusing on right now. It's that in-between space, the time that you acquire the firearm, you maybe somebody broke into your house. There was a recent case, 16-year-old kid in Virginia in 2013 who entered a house, believed that he was entering his own house, apparently, and the owner shot him. And I'm not going to argue whether that was a correct decision or not, but the owner is going to have to live with this for the rest of his life,
right.
Live with the fact that he took the life of a 16-year-old who was not really robbing his house. So that's kind of the situation that we're talking about. And really nobody in the firearms community is training this aspect.
No. I think the only one that's even coming remotely close would be Claude Werner with his negative outcomes research and all that. And even then, that's focusing more on misidentifying targets. You know, so we got about a minute and a half left in this segment, then we have to go to break. But what do you think?
Sure.
What do you think the number one thing that when people start talking about this or start thinking about it, what do you think the number one thing is that they miss or overlook?
Well, I think most of it is a training error where we're always on the line, we're always drawing and firing, and we're looking to increase our par times rather than assessing and then dealing with, you know, what tactically, what's our best thing to do right now, especially if we're not going to shoot. So, you know, it's a mindset more than it is anything else, and it has to be trained, because if it's not trained, specifically if it's not trained under pressure, it's not going to come out, and you're not going to think about it at the moment.
So just maybe a focus more on pure timer performance with less or not enough of a focus on the actual processing of this information?
Yeah, I think the processing of the information that you're taking in visually and even just not having the foresight to think, what happens if I have my gun out and I can't shoot the guy?
Right.
You know, I just don't have the authority to shoot the guy. Now, what could potentially happen? And that doesn't mean you can't shoot him later. Certainly, his actions
right.
might indicate.
Let me interrupt real quick. Hold that thought. We're talking with Larry Lindemann right now, and you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. This segment brought to you by Dark Star Gear. Whether you know the color of the boathouse at Hereford or only know the color of your mom's basement and Cheeto-stained socks, Dark Star Gear has a solution to your gear carrying needs. Check out their clip-on holster for small semi-autos and revolvers, or their highly adjustable full-size AIWB holster. They even have a belt-wrapped sheath for popular fixed-blade centerline knives to really tie your EDC together. Like that one rug I used to have before Jack ruined it. He's not a golfer. Designed, developed, and pressure-tested for real life, not Instagram. Find out more at darkstargear.com. And also, Aridus Industries and the patent-pending QDC Quick Detach Side Saddle Shell Carrier. Available now for pre-order. Would you like to know more? Desire to know more intensifies. Visit AridusIndustries.com, and that is A-R-I-D-U-S Industries.com, since there is some question as to how you spell that. So anyway, we're talking with Larry Lindemann. Larry, are you still there?
I am.
That's always a good thing. I'm sorry for interrupting you, the whole commercials thing. I know it's a bummer, but before the break, we were talking about the things that people sort of don't focus on, and you were sort of highlighting the performance chase aspect of a lot of people that are into this, I guess. It's like, if I can shave 1/10 of a second off of my draw time, or, you know, get a quicker reload, or things like that, and that's not necessarily what people should be focusing on?
You know, I think people should focus on it. I mean, I think it's an important part of your training cycle, but I also think that people have to focus on the tactical aspects of an encounter with a violent individual or a potentially violent individual. Every person that we you know, acquire our weapon for doesn't necessarily need to be shot into the ground.
Right.
So we have to train those things prior to getting in those situations. You know, critical situations are not the time to think about how to deal with critical situations.
Right. You're saying you're not going to come up with any really, really good ideas on the fly in the middle of that if you haven't thought about it beforehand?
Yeah. I've come up with some pretty bad ideas on the fly when I put myself in that situation. So,
right.
Yeah, it's better to train all that, you know.
So, I mean, it's the number one thing to acknowledge that ambiguity is something that exists in the real world and we need to prepare for it?
Yeah, you know, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting because, you know, there's a big argument about, or you know, you'll hear people argue against concealed carry because they say that you know, oh, these people aren't trained. I find that the civilians that I've trained with and that I train are much better prepared than police officers as far as shooting, drawing, just everything involved with firearms handling.
Right.
The one thing that police officers have that civilians don't have is the ability to manage chaos. Because what they do is every day they manage chaos. Every day they're managing people on the streets screaming, you know, domestic disputes, arguments, drunk people. So they're dealing with that on a daily basis, where in general you don't have – your general public is not dealing with that, thankfully.
Well, let me ask you this, and that brings an interesting point to mind. So they get better practice at dealing with chaos management, but do you think in some regards that almost lessens the impact and they get complacent at times when they find themselves in that situation?
Absolutely, John. I mean, I think if you track back most police officers who have been involved in use of force, generally they're, you know, we deal with this on the street on a daily basis, and you get complacent. You get to a point where you feel like, oh, I've got this handled, because I've done it 100, 200, 300 times. And that's why we can't get complacent. That's why when I was in SWAT, we always debriefed every operation. You know, we sat down and really went through it and made sure that anybody who made a mistake knew about it, because, you know, these are the things where, you know, you have this confirmation bias where I go in, I do something wrong, but I decide that day not to kill me, and I survive, therefore I'm a tactical stud, where in reality I'm making sometimes serious tactical errors. I'm just living because that whoever that person was decided it wasn't my day to die that day. So we have to narrow that window as much as possible.
Well, and that brings, you know, that's an interesting topic of conversation in and of itself that I've sort of been seeing a little bit more lately, is that, let me ask you this. Would you say that someone's background is always indicative of the quality of information they are presenting? I'm throwing you curveballs now.
Yeah, no. It's an interesting question. It's an interesting question because, I think – you know, clearly I've seen some instructors who have a really good competitive background, and they're great instructors in the arena that they teach. I have some really good people who have a really good tactical background, and they're really good instructors if they stay in their lane. So I think it's a situation where, as long as we're staying in our lane when we're instructing, and we're instructing things that we actually have experience in and that we could actually give real life examples for, then I think we're okay. I think it's when we start to stray outside of our lane as instructors and we start to talk about things that maybe we don't have that much experience in, but because the student expects cool guy stuff, they're going to, the instructor is going to try to provide that entertainment aspect.
Right.
I think that's where we get the trouble.
Well, and I'm sorry for the sidetrack. The reason why I brought it up is because you were mentioning, as far as, you know, getting the confirmation bias where I've done it this way X number of times and I've survived, so therefore my tactics are good.
Exactly.
You know, so anyway, back on topic. As far as, you know, the don't shoot yet, you know, the we someone that for whatever reason we have a firearm out or on because of the situation, a lot of people don't seem to think those exist. And there's actually a lot of really, even like you said, recent examples of circumstances that fall right into that, aren't there?
Well, right now I'm sitting in the city of Chicago. I'm sitting in my car in the city of Chicago. So if you hear gunfire, you'll know why. But it's really not that bad. But you know, there's an incident where a Chicago police officer was involved in a police officer, you know, a police officer involved shooting. And you know, this is a situation where you can make an argument that you know, especially with the Tulip drill, that he was 21 feet away, but he was. You know, he put himself in the situation where he was 21 feet away. He could have stayed in the car.
Right.
So, I mean, that argument is neither here nor there. But, you know, for law enforcement, for civilians, this happens a lot. And unfortunately, there's no statistics. There's no statistics to say how many armed citizens have drawn their weapon and stopped somebody from committing a crime just by the presence of the weapon being drawn. And what I'm saying is that I know people who have done that. I did that, and I'm not going to say it was a daily basis, but I did that at least a couple of times a month as a police officer, if not more. When I worked narcotics, we had our guns out all the time. And, you know, very rarely did the occasion occur where we had to shoot somebody. So there's tons of times where a weapon's out, but we're not recording it, and there's no way to record it. Because we're not keeping statistics on when we pull our weapon. And so this happens probably much more frequently than somebody drawing a weapon and actually firing it. But I don't know of anybody who's training drawing your weapon. And what do you do? How do you make that situation safe? Well, certainly the guy could run away, and that would maybe make that situation safe. There's some things you could do to maybe mitigate or make it a little bit safer. But now I have somebody who's verbally compliant. Let's say they break into my house. And I don't see a weapon in their hand, so I make the decision that I'm not going to shoot them at this time. That doesn't mean I'm not going to shoot them in a couple minutes or in 10 seconds, but at this time I make a decision not to shoot them. What do I do? How do I stabilize that situation?
Well, and it seems like not nearly enough people practice even talking with a gun in their hand. I know that's a common failing that, you know, you see all the time.
All the time. And it was readily apparent. There's a couple of things. One is I'm going to be moving potentially forward, potentially backward, and I want to have appropriate extension along that horizontal line of presentation or along that fore line. I want to have the appropriate extension and compression of the weapon. At the same time, I want to be able to talk and give directions to that person that I have at gunpoint, and I want to make what I'm saying to them as clear as possible so they could understand. I mean, the thing we see all the time in police work is one cop's yelling hands up, the other cop's yelling on your knees, the other cop's yelling on your stomach. And so this guy's hearing five different things, and he's under stress as well. We're under stress because we have a gun out on somebody who broke into our house. But at the same time, this person is under stress as well. So they're going to have a hard time. They're going to have that same tachypsychia. They're going to have that same lack of focus. So we have to clearly communicate to that person what we want them to do.
Well, and that seems to, you know, once again, it goes back into it's not as cool as a sub-1 second draw from concealment. It doesn't look as neat as like a sub-5 second fast drill, but those are the skills that maybe become more important simply because of the stakes if we get them wrong.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And now, you know, we're in an interesting era right now where police officers are questioning themselves, where civilians are questioning themselves, and where, you know, frankly, we need to be very careful. I mean, even if we are absolutely right, we're going to get sued. My narcotics unit, after we killed somebody who tried to run over one of my agents, we got sued for $10 million. I didn't get $10 million, but we got sued for $10 million.
Right.
Even though we were in the right. So, you know, for a drug unit in a police agency, we could absorb whatever we had to pay him. As a civilian, it might be harder to absorb that.
Well, and it becomes one of those situations where unless you get incredibly lucky and things are on camera from three different angles, you've got, you know, 10 different eyewitness accounts that all agree on what happened, and there's like, you know, a dead good guy at the feet of the bad guys that you have shot this bad guy off of, you're still going to have questions to answer.
Yeah, you're always a question.
Right. So we're coming up on the break. I kind of want to delve in this a little bit more, and then maybe we'll switch directions just a little bit. We're talking with Larry Lindemann. Right now you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. This segment brought to you by TopGunSupply.com. TopGunSupply.com is your web source for fine firearms parts and accessories. True Product Specialists committed to delivering the highest level of customer support to you. They carry top name brands including Ed Brown, Wilson Combat, Les Bear, Sig Sauer, and many more, as well as premium air pattern rifles. Whether you are looking to protect yourself, are a first-time gun buyer, or a competitor shooter, TopGunSupply.com can satisfy your firearms needs. TopGunSupply.com, your premier source for SIG parts and accessories. And also, Aridus Industries and the patent-pending QDC Quick Detach Side Saddle Shell Carrier, available now for pre-order. Would you like to know more? Visit AridusIndustries.com. So, we are talking with Larry Lindemann about pointing guns at people that we don't have to shoot yet, but maybe we will shoot later, and not knowing. And anyway, Larry, you're still there.
I am still here.
You did say you were sitting in a car in Chicago, so I wasn't sure if someone had stolen you yet or not.
Exactly.
So as far as why do you think people come up with these hard lines? They say things like, if someone's in my house, I'm going to blast them, without giving any thought to this. Why do you think that happens?
I just think, John, that I don't know if they're serious about that. I think that they run scenarios through their head and they come up with this hard line, but those same people are probably less likely to actually do anything like shoot everybody who walks into their house. I think we all have to deal with the fact that I think that we want to think that we're all, you know, hard guys and we could pull the trigger whenever we want. And a lot of people don't have to face that and never have to face that reality.
Right.
And, you know, at some point, you know, training is going to take over. And if you're training just to shoot and you're faced with kind of a dichotomy where you have to decide, do I shoot or don't shoot, you're just slowing down the process. And without taking into consideration the fact that you might not be shooting, you're not going to train for it. Without training for it, you're just slowing down your ability to stabilize the situation and make the situation safer for you and potentially your family. So people have to think about every possible scenario, and things that are trainable, they need to train. They need to have that experience.
Well, and John Hearn talks about, you know, he's got some really good lectures, but one of the things that he talks about is when do we get caught up on things and when does our brain get caught up on things? And usually it's novel stimuli, things that are new, things that we have not processed before, really slow down the processing time and the reaction time. And like you said, if the only thing that we have practiced is drawing to a timer and firing a shot, when it comes down to us trying to process information – and it's new to us, we start processing it slower. And if we don't need to fire a shot and do, that's a problem. But, you know, if we have to process information first and then fire a shot, but we're like hung up on all of that, that can be a problem too.
Yeah, exactly. And just the decisions that you have to make, if somebody enters your house and looks, it could be a drunk teenager, you know, next door neighbor that you just don't recognize, or it could be, you know, a violent criminal. If you have to make decisions on how am I going to stabilize the situation, what am I going to do? If you're making those decisions on the fly, you're not going to make the proper decisions. You're not going to have a procedure for dealing with it. And by not being confident, you're sending out signals to that person that you're weak. And anytime you send out signals that you're weak, you're potentially upping the chances that you're going to become a victim.
Well, and William April talked about that this last weekend as far as, you know, an air of professionalism being so very important to taking control of situations, you know, and the difference between commanding respect or demanding respect in that situation as far as looking like you know what you're doing and appearing to know what you're doing oftentimes can diffuse things or completely circumvent problems to begin with.
Yeah, you're not opening that window. It's one of the things as an Illinois State Police officer, we wear the Montana Peak, and you know our uniforms are squared away. And it was, you know, I know a lot of our officers complained about it because it wasn't the most comfortable thing in the world, but it transmitted a nonverbal message that we were squared away, and that that if you dealt with us, you're going to deal with somebody who is squared away.
Right.
And we generally, you know, I had people that I worked with that said they worked for a county police department before, and they stopped the same guys that they stopped when they were county officers, and when they were state police officers, the person was compliant. When they were county officers and their uniform maybe wasn't as squared away, the guy fought with them every time. So the way that we project ourselves to the world clearly is going to have an effect on how the world perceives us. Specifically, these violent criminal actors are going to perceive us if we're competent, and it looks like we've been in that situation before because we've trained to be in that situation before. They're going to make the decision, well, maybe not today. Maybe not today is the day that I'm going to take this chance. Whereas if we look like we're distracted or dithering or we're not exactly sure what we're going to do, somebody's going to take control of the situation, and it might be them. And that's certainly not what we want.
Well, and, you know, once again, that doesn't play into the good guy fantasy that is popular in the industry. And I'm not saying that it's not a good thing to try and achieve, but it's not the reality. A lot of times, you know, people don't like to think of themselves as Barney Fife on accident, you know.
Sure.
But as far as training for this, I would assume that one of the important things is to pressure test these techniques so that, you know, you're not just reinforcing bad habits and reinforcing false ideas.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, Craig Douglas does this, I think, the best in the industry. I think he's kind of a visionary when it comes to this type of training. And he has sort of the crawl, walk, run approach. And it's delved out in small, you know, the techniques are, they're minimal, they're effective, they're minimal, and then they're pressure tested in the end. And a weekend course clearly is not designed to make you an expert, but it clearly makes you a lot better than when you went in there. And it also shows you things that you might need to do or might need to train in order to make your total tactical presence that much better.
Well, the thing that I've always gotten, you know, out of the classes, I am very lucky in that I get to go and train a lot more than most people do.
Sure.
And the thing that I've always gotten out of like the weekend class and things like that is identifying areas where I need to work on them and learning ways to work on them on my own.
And, you know, I mean, one of the things that people notice right away when they take one of Craig's classes or when they take one of Paul Sharp's classes or Chris Fry or Cecil, any of these trainers, what they notice is the weak point is their ability to communicate under stress. That's generally what we see is that people break down in that muck or that managing unknown context. Area, people start to break down there because they don't do it. They don't have contact on a daily basis with street people. They don't have people approaching them on a daily basis. And so now you add in the fact, and one of the things we learned very quickly is that access to the weapon, being able to actually draw your weapon, is one of the hardest things to do under pressure, under actual physical pressure.
Right.
And then you add in the fact that you've got this task loading where you have to communicate with this person So you've got a lot of things going on, and you need to train those. And you need to train those on a fairly regular basis in order to be good at them so that you could project confidence when you're in a situation that, you know, that, that could potentially be life-threatening.
Well, and, you know, as someone that on a really good day, I think the quickest I've ever done it was like a draw to shot in like 0.87, something like that. And that's when I've been working it hard and practicing and all that. In something where there's actual pressure and processing information, it's a lot slower than that. And in real life situations, you know, the times where I've been forced to draw a firearm, it's happened pretty quick, but it's not happened nearly that quick. And I see a lot of guys, when they do this stuff, they are working techniques that only work if you're able to do it that fast. And that's just not the reality of the situation, is it?
It's not. It's not the reality of the situation. And it's very rare that situation is going to be as clear-cut. So, in other words, you're not going to be standing in front of somebody and somebody's going to yell gun, and you're going to have that's your cue to go.
Right.
That cue to go, you know, I mean, that person would be a crummy criminal if that's what they did every time they stood 5 yards away from the person they were going to rob. You know, they're masters of deception, and that's what they do to close that gap and get close. Is they utilize deception. So unless you're very, very good at managing the range, you could easily get caught up in and sort of behind the decision process or behind in the decision process where they're processing that information that much quicker than you are. They know what their goal is. They know what they're going to do. And you're sort of still catching up.
Right.
So
hold that thought real quick, Larry, just because we got to go to break again. Right now we're talking with Larry Lindemann. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. This segment brought to you by Tac Strike Steel Target Systems. Maker to the quarter scale steel target and the R-Trim target stand, which are literally the best steel targets and target stands I've ever used. Fit their steel targets with more than 60,000 rounds of rifle, pistol, and shotgun ammunition without a single problem. For more information, visit them at TacStrike.com. And also, Aridus Industries and the patent-pending QDC Quick Detach Side Saddle Shell Carrier. Available now for pre-order. Check out the new rigid, interchangeable side saddle carrier chain and how you look at shotguns forever. Find out why Steve Fry... Wow, I messed it up finally. After 2 months, Steve Fry... That'd be like a weird love child.
That is some Voltron right there.
Ooh, all the shotguns. Steve Fisher, Chris Fry, and myself all call it the best hard mount side saddle carry ever invented. Would you like to know more? Yeah, go visit AridusIndustries.com. Anyway, back to Larry Lindemann. So Jack's trying not to laugh right now. He's actually...
Yeah, I'm laughing too.
That's okay. That would be an interesting love child, Steve Fry. That'd be a hairy, big dude. Anyway, we were talking about before the break as far as like techniques that people can pull off like in very sterile static conditions and not being able to do them when they're at an initiative deficit or have different sorts of pressure applied to them. Why do you think so many people still focus on those sorts of skills, even though they don't always work in practice?
You know, I think that the it's interesting because there's, and I'm just speculating here, but I think the advent of simunition, marking cartridges, the advent of, or the popularity of mixed martial arts, from the 90s, you know, coming in from the 90s, these all shifted the paradigm of combat training and combat. And people started to be able to understood that they could pressure test. Prior to that, there wasn't a heck of a lot of pressure testing going on. And I'd been involved in martial art for 40 years. And frankly, we didn't pressure test a lot of our stuff. We looked in the back. We looked at, or back in the day, we looked at we had this division between sport and, you know, martial art. And sport was, yeah, you're doing it for points, but in the real world, this is how this is going to work. And unfortunately, that turned out to not be true. And people go into, I remember as a martial artist, never knowing, you know, never getting to the point or getting to this point where I was like, yeah, I think I'm pretty skilled, but I don't know.
Right.
And as a practitioner of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and working with Simunition and working with the trainers that I work with, and, you know, going through SWAT, now I know because I've had real life experience, but I've also had real life or very close to real life experience in training that maybe until 10 or 15 years ago, we weren't really able to do. And not many trainers have taken advantage of the technology that we have now to push that edge. And I think a lot of trainers just get stuck in what they know and they don't want to push the edge because they're teaching us, they don't want to say they were wrong in the past. They're teaching a certain technique. And a lot of times they don't want to embarrass themselves by putting themselves under pressure.
Well, and so the thing that I, the funny thing for me that I've noticed, like when I went through ECQC, it was a terrible, terrible experience where I got destroyed like on multiple levels. And you want to talk ego crushing, but I was talking with Craig about this maybe a year and a half later. And the thing that I've noticed is I've done this more, like when I compare the force on force stuff that I've done to real life incidents I found myself in, for whatever reason, the training was more stressful at the time than the real life incidents I found myself in. I'm not quite sure why that is. But it was interesting, an interesting realization for me, just from like the stress inoculation standpoint and that how my body reacted to it standpoint, you know?
Yeah, I mean, when we first got Simunition, it was back in the 90s when I was in SWAT, and nobody had used it. We were actually having to shoot it out of revolvers because we weren't able to shoot it out of a semi-auto yet. And when we first started training, and these are guys who had real-life experience, hundreds and hundreds of real-life search warrants, hostage rescues. And what we did is we would pump them up mentally. We would say, hey, this is going to hurt a lot when you get hit with it. These things hurt. You know, we're evaluating your performance. And then we would put them in a scenario where, you know, I remember specifically one where I had my ID and my star in my back pocket. And we ramped up the atmospherics. We were screaming and yelling and, you know, these guys were coming down the hallway, and I walk out and I go, you guys just blew a 6-month, and I pull my star out to show them my star, and these guys lit me up. The pressure that they were feeling was so strong that they just lit me up, and because they fully expected that I was going to pull a gun out of my pocket, and I pulled the star. And so, but these are guys who've done hundreds of search warrants where guns were pulled on them. And, you know, so I think that in training, you know that we're trying to put you in a deep hole in training. And in real life, I don't know if we really, you know, it's pretty rare that we get in that deep of a hole. And that's good. That's what we want to do in training.
Well, and I almost wonder if you get yourself into that deep of a hole in real life, you don't tend to survive that all the time, you know?
Well, right. Yeah, sure. Definitely.
But it was just a weird realization, though, because, like, I know some people sort of diss the value of that kind of training. And in my experience, you know, and I'm not saying I'm some cool guy ninja or anything like that, but in my experience, it's pretty close. You know, it's pretty close. But so we're coming up on we got a couple minutes left in the show.
Sure.
If you could tell people about your training company, where they can find you at, you know, stuff like that. I'd love to hear it, and I'm sure they want to know.
Absolutely. Well, I have a website, brand new, Point Driven Training, where I've written out, and I'm in the process of writing about a 4 or 5 part article about managing the don't shoot yet. So that's at pointdriventraining.com. And I just opened a Facebook page yesterday morning, so I'm on Facebook at Point Driven Training. I'm in the Chicago area, and my former SWAT commander, retired Illinois State Police, he was a statewide SWAT commander, really great guy, really tactical guy. His name is Pete Negro. And my other partner, Roy Sanji, are opening a range. They're at www.range355.com. It's going to be open in January, and I'll be teaching out of there. I'll be teaching at Range Master, and I hope to see you there. I'm not sure if you're going to be there or not, you and Jack, but I'll be teaching there at Range Master. But probably the best way is either Facebook or directly on the website.
So there's this long-running joke that I never make the TAC conferences for multiple reasons, and I might actually get to make this one. We'll see. I'm not 100% certain yet. As far as what's one thought, I guess, you want to leave everybody with that maybe they should consider about this if they haven't already?
Yeah, hopefully that we've sort of opened the door for expanding training into how to control a compliant subject. Understanding that the reality of the situation is that most people, once they interject a firearm into the process, that completely changes what's going on. If that person drops a weapon or if that person backs away, of course, at this point, we're not gonna fire a shot. We shouldn't fire a shot.
Right.
And once that happens, we need to manage that situation so that us and our family and we're safe. And the only way that we're going to be able to do that is by thinking about it beforehand and by training for that possibility.
Right. Well, I appreciate you coming on tonight, Larry. The outro music should be playing any second. Hey, look at that. It's like magic. You be safe, brother. I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, brother.
All right.
Really appreciate it, Jack. Thank you. Great seeing you guys last weekend.
Hey, yeah. You too, man. Take it easy. So next week, we've got Eric Dutrec on from MDFI talking about the Brian Terry Foundation. Also, a charity auction we're doing for SHOT Show. Some other stuff. Oh, yeah, make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Thanks for listening, everyone. To be safe. See you next week.